of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, a recent SFU conference highlights the risks climate change poses to our aging population and what we can do about it. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more. The Public Health Association of BC is recruiting two more Northern BC participants for its Rise Up program that offers an in-depth experience as students work towards independent food systems and environmental stewardship. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio in Prince George has that story. The City of Nanaimo resumed public hearings regarding 75 acres of land that would be rezoned from rural resource to industrial, which has residents up in arms. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo reports. And in Smithers at CAZK News, this week marked Violence Prevention Against Women, a crucial time for northern communities to confront the urgent issue of domestic violence. Pam Hassan has that story. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. In recent years, it has become ever more apparent that older Canadians are at greater risk of the impacts of climate change. From extreme heat events to poor air quality due to wildfires, that vulnerability has been made abundantly clear. However, the role that older adults play in climate action policies hasn't been as widely discussed, and on this year's Earth Day, April 22nd, Simon Fraser University hosted the 33rd John K. Friesen Conference, for which the theme of this year was Climate Change in an Aging World. Through panel discussions and presentations with academics across BC and beyond, the goal of the conference was to highlight the role of older Canadians in climate action. Before the April 22nd start of the conference, CJSF spoke with two academics involved, Gloria Gutman, a gerontology professor at SFU and co-chair and manager for the conference, as well as Gary Hack, a human ecologist, author, and research associate at the University of York in England. He attended the conference as a keynote speaker, and we had the opportunity to speak with them both about what this conference would entail.
In terms of this issue of aging and climate change, as Gloria said, I've been looking at it since about 2007, 2008, looking at this intersection of aging and climate change, but taking a much more kind of holistic approach, because of, we've developed this framework, what we call the three C's. So looking at older people as contributors to the problem. So we know for in terms of carbon footprint and consumption, and let's say the baby boomer generation, one study I looked at how we can look at age-related carbon footprint and how consumption and emissions change over time. For example, maybe in early retirement, if they have the money available, their carbon footprint is mainly on travel, eating out. But as you get older and less mobile, then it becomes more on home heating and health services. So looking at the three C's, the first one is contributor to the problem, casualty and change maker. The second C is about casualty, because we know a high proportion of older people are impacted by the effects of climate change, such as heat or having to evacuate from flooding, which has issues. And then the third one is looking at change makers, because we know that we have, of an older population, we have enormous wealth and knowledge and experience that they can utilize. So it's really coming to this intersection as a much more holistic and balanced approach, because it's easy to say from one example, oh, well, you know, older people, they consumed and they, you know, they cause a problem, or older people are only vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. It's trying to look at it holistically and saying, yes, we recognize contribution, casualty and change maker. And at this conference, because it's on Earth Day, I'll be exploring how older people, this intersection, and explaining this kind of framework approach.
Well, amongst other things, what we discovered is that there are groups all across the country of seniors that are activists, that are trying to deal with these issues of climate change and how do we mitigate the problem.
Later on in our conversation, we spoke about why they believe the conversation around climate action has taken longer to include the voices of aging populations.
I think the first thing is that we're now seeing the impacts of climate change more and more. You know, so we're seeing the wildfires, we're seeing the heat, we're seeing the flooding and the storms, and we're seeing that older people are being impacted. So that the evidence is more. We're experiencing much more extreme weather events, and we're seeing how it impacts older people. So I think that's one why it's more now compared to the past. It's more evidence of that change. I also think that at the time when we were doing it, there wasn't that much interest because of from a kind of more the aging community. You can we're aware about the impacts of climate change. So I think there's an increased awareness of climate policy, but climate impacts. I would say that's my perspective. But Gloria, from a gerontology point of view.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, where I first got involved in this was back around Hurricane Katrina, and realizing that the people who died were not the babies and the nursing mothers. It was the old people. And then we started to see in disaster after disaster that was the pattern. So the issue of older people as casualty was sort of where it drew a number of us in. But subsequent to that is that we were seeing this activism that was not there before. So now there's a group called Gray is Green that's in the U.S. that is very active. And, you know, when you think about it, and as Gary said, taking a lifespan perspective, that some of those people who are old now were the ones who were the protesters in their youth, right? So they were protesting for the women's movement, for the gay movement, for disability rights. And so they know how to do this.
Once again, that was our conversation with Gloria Gutman and Gary Hack about the 33rd John K. Friesen Conference, which took place from April 22nd to April 23rd at the SFU Harbor Center campus. We spoke about the conference's theme, Climate Change in an Aging World, and the three C's that can be attributed to aging populations as contributors, casualties, and change makers in climate action. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Today in studio at CIFA Radio, we have a guest, Joe Van Winkle. Thank you so much for joining us, Joe.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You're involved in local food security, and the way that you're engaging with that is you happen to be the regional lead for the northern region of the Rise Up program.
Yeah.
And that program has been created by a PHABC, which is the Public Health Association of BC. That's a nonprofit, but it's here within the province. And that nonprofit managed to access some federal funding through the CSC, or the Canadian Service Corps, which encourages youth to volunteer, develop leadership skills, engage in the community, that kind of thing. And what a great way to divert that energy into local food security.
Absolutely.
So you need to recruit some volunteers, some young folks to help you what? Garden? Tell us about it.
Well, gardening is one thing for sure they could be doing. So we're going into our cohort number two. This is our second full year of the program. And we've got room for about 2 to 4 youth still. And they could be volunteering anywhere from with local farms, local nations. We've got youth with Everyone at the Table here in Prince George helping with their food policy council development.
It's another separate nonprofit.
Oh, totally separate.
Okay.
Yeah. Really, you don't need to have any experience to join our program. The idea is you just need to be interested in kind of getting more involved in your community. Depending on your level of experience and your interests, we'll work to try and find you a host organization that works with what you're looking for, whether that's more in person, more online, something to get your hands dirty. We've got people working with PG Perg here over the summer with their gardening. And yeah, it's just a great opportunity to get involved and learn more about environmental stewardship and sustainability and the such.
So yeah. It's not limited to throwing a shovel into the dirt and getting dirty. There's all kinds of ways to coordinate, get involved in whatever it is, whatever your skill set is, you can contribute to this program.
Absolutely. I think that...
Or lack of skill set.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, yes. You could be interested in farming. You could have never heard of hydroponics. Like any sort of experience is needed and necessary. I think that everyone has so much to provide and gain from these kinds of things. We also, if there's any host organizations out there in Prince George that would like to take on some youth, we are absolutely open to having a couple more of those. It really is just a wonderful opportunity to get involved in community and learn some new skills. I think because we're working with youth, which by the federal definition is 15 to 30, which is quite broad, we understand that we have people coming from high school, university, full-time jobs. There's a lot of availability differences between our youth. And so the whole point of my role is to try and facilitate finding you something that works with that.
You're kind of acting, in a sense, in this program as not a job placement program, but a volunteer placement program connecting different organizations with interested volunteers and youth.
Exactly. And the total program, so you have a year to complete 120 volunteer hours, which sounds a little daunting, but part of that includes online education modules we provide, any service hours that you do with your host organizations. We also have a provincial retreat that will be happening in October, and we're actually getting all the youth to come with us to the island, and they get to meet people from the other regions as well.
So there's some incentives for the youth built in too. It's not just the cereal is the prize kind of situation.
Correct. Yeah.
Oh, neat. I can imagine there might be a few farmers out there listening right now, a few employers in the food related world thinking, oh, this is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it doesn't even have to be free physical labor. I've got a youth up in Smithers who's working on designs for some swag for a farm up there so that they can get a little bit of proceeds through that. So there's a lot of different ways that they could be providing the help as well. If we end up getting some really tech savvy youth, they could help with websites. Like there's so many opportunities that arise. For example, Kitsum Kalem, who's one of our host organizations, is working on building out their self-governance structure right now. And so there's so many potentials for people down the line to be able to work in that area and help them do that.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I would not have considered that from the Rise Up poster. You know, you're looking
totally.
Get involved in food systems of your community. Immediately, my brain goes to gardening. I did
yes.
not think of developing governance systems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this might be a tangent, but I just had a meeting yesterday with Dakota from Kitsum Kalem, and he's in charge of developing their agriculture sector within their self-governance structure. And so he's going to be taking on a youth who's going to help garden for sure, but over the next 2 years, he has to develop 350 acres. And so part of the youth's position will be helping to plan that.
What a experience.
One that you just would not have unless you were already connected with the nation. So
in case it hasn't been clear to the audience so far, this program is not at all limited to Prince George,
no.
Prince George area. It is throughout northern BC.
Yeah.
I should ask you, you know, through mm-hmm. your title as the regional lead
yeah.
for the northern region, just how big is the northern region?
Oh, it's huge. If we're looking at based on like health authority size, we cover 55 First Nations. I believe it's over 600,000 kilometers.
PHABC is a nonprofit organization. It exists and services basically British Columbia.
Yes.
It goes all over the province. There's other regional leads in different areas mm-hmm. of the province that have similar roles to yourself. There's one on the island, Fraser Valley, et cetera, and yeah. right here in Prince George, on and on. This program received federal funding through the Canada Service Corps, which is pretty neat. But to be clear, this program is not federally led. Like, you're not receiving a directive from the federal government or something, be like, look at food security in your region. This is an initiative that came up through PHABC, and there are also other organizations in the community that are also interested in food security that you happen to be collaborating with, working on this. Again, this isn't some larger directive coming from somewhere higher above you.
No, right? From my understanding, it isn't. I believe Canada Service Corps had grants available. We applied for it with our goal of bolstering local food systems and stewardship. And we do quarterly reporting to Canada Service Corps so that they know what's going on with their funding and things like that.
Right, typical grant reporting that has to happen.
Exactly.
Sure. But all in all, this is like essentially a grassroots initiative.
Yeah, it is. It was put together by Richard, who's part of PHABC, and it's had a pilot project here in Prince George a few years ago. So it's something that has been in the works for a while, and we hope will continue past when this funding ends.
If people really like this program and what it's doing, who should they send their letters of support to?
If you're in the north, you can send them to me at northern.riseup@phabc.org, and I can forward them onto our project lead. That's probably the easiest way to do that, just so she's not receiving a bunch of emails from the north wondering why. I can provide a little bit of context. But yeah, if you're someone who thinks you might be interested in being a host organization in the future, or just providing some like words of support that we could use later when we're applying for more grants, send them my way and I'll make sure they get to the right people.
Thanks for talking about your off. It's
no
great.
Problem.
That's Joe Van Winkle, the Northern Regional Lead for Rise Up, a food security program offered by the PHABC, or the Public Health Association of BC, a voluntary, non-profit, non-government, member-driven organization operating throughout the province, and in this case, a community near you in northern BC. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHY News update. Once again, the Shaw Auditorium was packed with concerned locals before City Council, voicing their opinions on the proposed rezoning of the land near the popular Cable Bay Trail. On Wednesday, April 2nd, the City of Nanaimo continued its public hearing regarding the 75 hectares of land near the southeast edge of Nanaimo at Duke Point. This land would be rezoned from Rural Resource, or RA1, to Industrial, or I-4. According to the City of Nanaimo, I-4 zoning can be used for, quote, heavy industrial development that is not compatible with residential use, end quote. The current zoning of Rural Resource allows for agricultural and rural uses. The land is owned by Nanaimo Forest Products, also known as Harmac Pacific. Over 70 people spoke in person or over the phone in the public hearing at the Vancouver Island Conference Center, where two overflow rooms were available for attendees. While Nanaimo Forest Products CEO Paul Sadler and some members of the community spoke in favor at the first public hearing on April 16th, all 72 speakers at Wednesday's public hearing were opposed to the rezoning. Members and elders from the Sinaimuk First Nations were the first to speak, including Elder Stephen Thomas.
I'm going to voice my opposition to the rezoning application. I believe proper protocol wasn't followed when the leadership of the Sinaimo were excluded from the onset of the rezoning application. Talks with Sinaimo needed to begin the process, as federal and provincial legislation require no exclusion of First Nations leadership in regard to their ancestral territory being discussed in talks about future development. Negotiations are now definitely going to be part of the process moving forward.
He says, as the Sinaimuk elder, he believes it is their duty to save the area for future generations.
I hike this area extensively, and the wildlife is in great abundance and easily accessible to see and enjoy. I've personally seen killer whales, sea lions chasing salmon onto the beach, deer on the trail, owls, eagles, and blue herons. Dodds Narrows is close by, and salmon pass through, and it's home to shellfish, crabs, oysters, and clams, a staple of ours. Another industrial site would jeopardize this, so we must protect the area to the best of our ability.
Right before the Wednesday public hearing, the Sinaimuk First Nations issued a statement strongly opposing the rezoning application, stating the lands in question are treaty protected, culturally important, and that the process is moving ahead without Sinema consent. In the statement, Chief Mike Wise states that the land represents a, quote, integral part of Sinemuk historical village sites, cultivated fields, gathering places, hunting grounds, and resource camps protected by the Sinemuk-Sarlacan Treaty of 1854, end quote.
Councillors, I have stood in oil on a marine foreshore in an actual quick deployment emergency. I have been so covered in it myself that I struggled with the reality of bringing that contamination into my family home. I know what it looks like when intelligent design fails. We can walk away from a spill, go home, and wash it off. The life in that water cannot.
That's Roxanne Croxall, a local environmental scientist and consultant. She spoke to the concerns of what more industry could bring, pointing to the recent January 2026 oil spill that saw a sizable amount of diesel enter into the Northumberland Channel between Duke Point and Gabriel Island. Harmac itself was not involved.
I think it is imperative to point out that that spill originated from a diligently engineered, licensed disposal facility specifically designed to contain industrial waste. Councillors, if an intelligently engineered, licensed disposal facility cannot contain a spill, and our bureaucratic systems cannot coordinate a response, you cannot guarantee the safety of our shoreline.
The rezoning would require a 100-meter average buffer between the industrial land and the Cable Bay Trail. Croxall says it's not enough for the endangered species currently living there. She stressed the importance that the Cable Bay Trail and the surrounding areas have for the community.
This past weekend, Mr. Mayor, I watched as you stood next to my daughter at the opening of the new recreational ENN trail. You proposed a revision to Robert Frost's Mending Wall poem. You spoke of good neighbors making good trails. In the spirit of the actual poem, it is the landscape, not the fence, that connects us. Good trails make good neighbors. Cable Bay is that trail.
The Wednesday public hearing recessed at 11 p.m. The public hearing for the Cable Bay rezoning will resume on April 30th at 7 p.m. at the Shaw Auditorium at the Vancouver Island Conference Center. For CH1 News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. This week marks Violence Prevention Against Women Week in British Columbia, a critical time for our northern communities to reflect on the pressing issues surrounding gender-based violence. With alarming statistics showing that 1 in 3 women will experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime, today we'll hear from Bronwyn Young, a worker at the Northern Society for Domestic Peace, who's raising awareness through a powerful art installation, as well as Constable Jocelyn Foydart from the Smithers RCMP, who will discuss the law enforcement perspective on these challenging issues. Together, they're going to provide insight into the realities faced by survivors and the collective responsibility that we share in creating a safer community.
My name is Bronwyn Young.
Okay, Bronwyn, we're at the corner of Main and 2nd, and you are blindfolded, and you also have handprints on you. Can you tell me what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. So this is Violence Prevention Against Women Week, and I'm out here doing a bit of an art installation, call to action, just to promote awareness and participation in the conversation around preventing violence against women.
And what is the installation?
So I'm here on the corner. I've got some different colored paints and some gloves for people who are willing and feeling brave enough to put a handprint on me to show their solidarity or to acknowledge their their experiences with violence. And I'm quite impressed by people who are sharing this with me. I feel like my body is quite full of people's handprints.
It is. I'll show you the picture after, because for listeners, you're also blindfolded. Why are you blindfolded?
Because there's so much shame around violence against women, particularly for the women who have experienced violence. And I wanted them to feel that they could walk up to me without having to necessarily make eye contact or to feel that layer of vulnerability. I'll take the vulnerability for them.
And your sign says, if you have been affected by violence, leave a sign. Do you know when someone is leaving a handprint on you? Are people speaking to you as well when this is happening? Can you walk me through that?
Sure. So it's been a variety of experiences with these handprints. Sometimes it is a small town. People say, oh, that's Bronwyn. And then they come over, and I've known them from the past through my work with Domestic Peace. And we have a conversation. Other people are having conversations with my lovely colleagues who are here with me. And some are quite quiet. just want to know a couple things and then leave a handprint.
This is about awareness. It's also about visibility as well, though. But do you feel vulnerable in this situation and kind of what's going on inside you for that?
I don't. And the reason why I don't is because as a woman coming out here to do this, I knew I needed a safety plan. And so I created some safety around me to do this in a way that was not going to make me feel vulnerable. So I give thanks to my colleagues again for being my spotters while I'm out here and helping to ensure that this is a safe experience.
Absolutely. What do you feel is your motivation for not only visibility, but also the work that you constantly do toward preventing violence against women and female identifying people?
I'm really hoping and striving for men to step up into the conversation and to be advocates and protectors and to say something when they see something, when they hear something, and to really encourage the men around them to do better. There are a lot of good men in our community, and one of the things about violence is that it is so hidden, especially in intimate partner violence or in sexual violence. And so please, gentlemen, do what you can to help protect the women in your community.
What does that look like from the NSDP? Do you have services or even like resources or documentation for men who maybe they hear it and they think, well, that's, you know, I'm not violent, and that's kind of maybe as far as a lot of men go with this. Mm-hmm. What would you like them to do to go further?
Please talk to the women in your life. So there are statistics that say that one in either every 2 to 3 women will experience sexual or physical violence in their lifetime. So it is an epidemic. It is happening all around us. And the culture of permissive behavior around this needs to end. And I do believe that men need to take the lead in that.
Mm-hmm. I'm Constable Jocelyn Floydart. I'm your media relations officer for Smithers.
Okay, so we're at the corner of Main and Second here. I just had an interview with Bronwyn about really her drivers for exposure, information about violence toward women. But what do you feel like needs to change?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first of all, so far this year, we've had 33 reported cases of intimate partner violence. So that number in itself is actually, for our community, quite large. And those are women who feel brave to come forward and share with police, you know, situations that they're in that are violent. What we're very concerned about is the number of women and families who are currently living at risk who don't feel comfortable reporting to police or live in states of violence because the systems are not set up in a way that is incredibly trauma-informed for those survivors to come forward. So I think that this event today is really important, and this week is really important, because we want, you know, the women and children in our community who more often than men are victims of violence to know that there are an abundance of service providers in the community who can help you navigate that process from reporting to the police all the way through the court process.
Can you walk me through what you want to see changed there?
I think that when women are brave enough to come forward and then charges to Crown Council are not approved, I think what people need to realize is that actually leaves the woman even more at risk than she was in the first place. So she's been brave enough to come forward and brave enough to provide a statement to police and brave enough to say, hey, I want my voice to be heard. And then if charges aren't approved or the court process itself isn't trauma-informed, now that woman and her family are potentially more at risk now that they've reported. So I think, you know, as a community, as a society, I think we need to really, you know, not soften the language around this. I think we need to talk plainly and transparently about what this process looks like for women and how hard it is to go through from beginning to end.
While Constable Floydart highlights the importance of an informed and compassionate response from law enforcement. Thank you for taking the time to listen today, and thanks especially to Bronwyn Young and Office and Constable Jocelyn Floydart for their time. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the local journalism and...
You have tuned in to Open Mic on CJSF Radio, broadcasting on 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
I know you're a decent human being, but die like a dog.